Radio EcoShock.
Our guest is a world expert in extreme storms. Dr. Kerry Emanuel is professor of atmospheric science at MIT and co-director of the Lorenz Center. Since his first paper in 1977, and well over 100 research papers later, Kerry's passion and research led to his 2005 book, Divine Wind, The History and Science of Hurricanes. Dr. Emanuel just co-authored two key papers warning about cyclones in a warming world. From New England, Kerry Emanuel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good to be with you.
Considering we have at least a century of records about tropical cyclones, why do we still see very different projections of what could happen to big storms during climate change?
So part of the problem is a technical problem, is that we, you know, the climate is a very complex system. And because of that, we rely on rather sophisticated computer models to make detailed forward projections. And there are many different models around the world. That's deliberate because different people have to make different approximations, and we get some idea of the uncertainty that way. But the problem with all of these models is that they're not yet fine enough in resolution to really capture hurricanes. And so we have to make deductions that are a bit indirect. And so there are nevertheless some things that emerge fairly robustly from these studies, one of which is that, and basic theory, by the way, not just models, is that hurricanes ought to become more intense as we warm the climate. Not necessarily more frequent, but more intense. And we're beginning to see that happen. Another fairly robust finding is that as we warm the climate, the latitudes at which these storms tend to reach their peaks should increase in both hemispheres. They should be moving closer to the pole. And finally, and probably most importantly, a given storm is likely to rain a lot more in a warmer climate.
But frequency matters. In the Caribbean and North America, there were years when several large hurricanes, one after the other, slammed ashore before anyone could recover or rebuild. Another one wreaked more damage. Kerry, could predicting frequency be as important as knowing storm intensity?
Absolutely. And the fact that we aren't confident about that is just an honest statement of where the science is. It's not a statement that we don't think it's important. It's just a much tougher problem. And the Atlantic, by the way, is kind of a special place. We know it behaves a bit differently from the other oceans that have tropical cyclones. And there have been all kinds of things that have influenced the hurricane climate of the Atlantic, of which global warming is just one.
The strongest storm on record did happen in the Pacific in both size and wind speeds. It was Typhoon Tip in October 1979. Given what is known about the physics of tropical cyclones, is there a natural upward limit to how strong these storms could become?
There is an upward limit. In fact, I was the one who discovered it theoretically more than 30 years ago and published in Nature magazine. But that upper limit is a function of the climate state. As you warm the atmosphere, or cool the very high atmosphere, if you warm the ocean and cool the high atmosphere, storms should become more intense. And we made projections back then that global warming would lead to a perceptible increase in the intensity of these storms.
The paper, Poleward Expansion of Tropical Cyclone Latitudes in Warming Climates, was published in Nature Geoscience December 29, 2021. Your team explains a key concept. About 30% of tropical cyclones are driven by factors heavily influenced by climate change. Can you explain that for the educated non-specialist?
Sure. There are all kinds of factors that influence hurricanes as they affect us. We have talked about intensity and frequency are two important factors that are controlled by the environment. But there are other factors. For example, where do these storms form? And once formed, where do they move? The tracks of the storms. Shifts in the tracks of the storms, which might accompany climate change, are terribly important because storms could move toward coastlines or away from coastlines, and even if their frequency is changing, that could be offset locally by the changes in the track. So at the end of the day, I like to say all climate change is local. That is, we can make sweeping statements about what happens to hurricanes around the world. Their frequency will do this, their intensity will do that. But what really matters to most people and what we're very concerned about is how does it change where you live or someplace you're concerned about? And you can have situations, and in fact, the model will show this, that global warming will actually decrease the intensity and or frequency of hurricanes in certain places, like Fiji in the South Pacific. So you have to be very careful to recognize that it's a complex problem, and yeah, the changes that we're worried about are local changes.
You and your colleagues examined cyclone conditions going back many millions of years. So what did you find?
So in that case, we looked at models of the past climates, including climates of the ice ages. And although I think more work needs to be done on that, we found that during very cold times, hurricanes, as theoretically expected, are not as intense, but they're actually more frequent in certain places. So again, we have to be very careful about which of those results are really robust. But it's fascinating to look at the various factors that control hurricane activity.
And there were periods a few million years ago when Earth had more carbon in the atmosphere than today and was very hot. Did they have great storms then?
Well, you know, we'd like to know. And obviously one way of estimating that is to run computer models of the past. But I think most of us would feel more confident if we had direct evidence. Now, there is this budding field called paleotempestology, which does look for geological evidence of past storms. So far, we've been able to look back only about 6,000 years. It's really tough to look back millions of years, but not out of the question. And so, yes, you ask an excellent question, and there are some indications that the storms millions of years ago when the climate was very warm were, in fact, more intense, but might have been less frequent.
Yeah, I recall in a 2016 paper, James Hansen and 18 co-authors shone a spotlight on storms in past ages stronger than anything seen today. They said some moved giant rocks inland on the Caribbean islands. Carrie Emanuel, what do you make of this theory, and does it point towards superstorms to come as we heat the planet?
Well, I think that the most robust result we have so far is this increase in the speed limit, if you will, of hurricane winds as you warm the climate or decrease as you cool it. And we're relatively confident about that, and we're very confident about the fact that warming air means more rain from a given storm. And of course, we'd like to know about the past, and that would certainly lend confidence in what we expect theoretically or make us go back to the drawing board. The water thing, I can't emphasize how important water is. It kills a lot more people than wind in hurricanes, both the freshwater flooding from torrential rains and the surge of salt water that's pushed forward by the storm. It's essentially the same thing as a tsunami, but forced by wind rather than shaking seafloor. Those are the devastating aspects of tropical cyclones worldwide and have killed far more people than wind. But it gets a lot less attention. And we're very worried about the fact that rising sea level and heavier rains are going to exacerbate flooding from hurricanes.
And you've got a new paper on that, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But looking at this December paper, you talk about poleward expansion. So bringing this down to Earth, what does your team's new analysis suggest for cities in the American Northeast, for example? Could New York become known as a storm city like New Orleans is?
Well, I hope not. And again, it tends to be a local thing. New York, because it's sort of set inland a little bit compared to, say, Cape Hatteras or Cape Cod, dodges most of the hurricanes that travel up that way. But we do show in the paper that, at least according to the analyses we did, in general, the Northeast should experience more storms as the climate warms. But there are maybe regions deep within the Caribbean, on the other hand, that experience a decrease in the number of storms. So the poleward expansion is not bad news for everyone. I wouldn't go so far as to say the storms in New York City will be as devastating as the ones in New Orleans. But, you know, if you look at it, all cultures, all cities, towns, habitations are really pretty well acclimated to the climate we've experienced in the last few hundred years. People build up an experience base. They know what to build for. Problems happen when things go outside the bounds of history. Then your structures, your highways, your subways weren't built for. And that's when the trouble really happens.
Does your work apply to so-called bomb cyclones like the damaging winter storm that recently struck New England?
You know, not directly. Our work doesn't directly apply to storms like that. As a matter of fact, you ask an excellent question because these bomb cyclones, sometimes around here called nor'easters, do a lot of damage and are very costly. But the jury is out still on how climate change might affect storms like that. Theoretically, it's a very interesting problem. There are factors that would tend toward having more intense storms and other factors that would tend in the opposite direction. So we're still working on that. There's an awful lot to do in climate science still.
The December study in Nature looks at poleward shifts. Does it apply equally to expansion in the southern hemisphere, like the tropical cyclone Batsirai that just wiped out villages in Madagascar?
Yes, it should apply broadly in the southern hemisphere as well. And that cyclone that just hit Madagascar was devastating, but it wasn't unusual in the latitude it occurred at. Madagascar has suffered devastating cyclones in the past.
Well, staying in the south for a minute, tropical cyclones generally hit northern Australia and Queensland. Other than a deadly freak tropical cyclone in 1954, big cities like Sydney do not get cyclones. Could that change as the planet warms?
You know, that's a good question. I think we're in a position to at least take a shot at the answer to it. I don't think anyone has looked in great detail about how the poleward expansion might affect storms specifically in Australia, but it's a good question.
As you say, the conclusions of this December paper, it's a bit mixed. It seems there are different changes at work in different oceans. Storms in the Atlantic may be more influenced by changes in polar ice, while in the Pacific, ocean warming may draw big storms away from land and into the open ocean, a different storm track. Is that correct?
Yeah, all climate change is local. Whether those specific changes that are coming from our analyses and models are correct, we'll have to wait and see, but it's our best shot at it so far.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Carrie Emanuel from MIT. We're talking about dangerous changes in the most powerful storms as we overheat the world's climate. Let's move to your latest paper. With Avantika Gori and others, you co-author Tropical Cyclone Climatology Change Greatly Exacerbates U.S. Extreme Rainfall Surge Hazard. That's just out in Nature Climate Change, February 3rd. What is the connection between extreme rains and storm surges?
Well, they both cause flooding, but it's more interesting than that. What we're really worried about in this paper and in other papers is something called compound flooding, where you have both a surge of water trying to get to the sea from inland, resulting from torrential rains, and a temporary but large elevation of sea level because of the storm surge. The collision of those two can be somewhat worse than if they occurred separately, just adding their effects. And we call that the compound hazard. We're very worried about that. And let me just explain again that water is much more of a threat than wind in most hurricanes, at least. They've certainly killed a lot more people and done more damage historically. Not in all storms, but on average. The problem really is when you look at any risk of natural hazard, you see, of course, that the most devastating events are very rare. And it goes along with that if you shift the climate a bit, the biggest fractional changes in the incidents occur in the tails of the distributions. That's where you get the really large increases. And so when you try to convert a weather hazard like a hurricane into an actual risk, it's almost always dominated by the rarest strongest events. So if you know, over a long period of time, it's those events which will cause the most damage. The problem is that, of course, we don't have very good historical records of very rare events, and they're harder to model. But generally speaking, where we are able to model them, as in this paper, you see the biggest changes in the tails of the distributions, and we certainly see that in the case of the of coastal flooding from hurricanes.
For years, from both scientists and environmentalists, we've seen maps of sea level rise and Miami goes under eventually and things like that. But you seem to explain that tropical cyclones are a threat to the U.S. coastal cities and the countryside greater than rising sea levels. Could you explain that, please?
Yeah. So the rising sea level is a factor in the increased flood risk. So most of the floods that occur today don't occur under normal weather conditions, but occur when you have a storm that locally raises the elevation of the water, the so-called storm surge. So if you have sea level rise and you have a storm surge, and especially if it happens to be high tide when the storm happens, you sum all those three, you're much more likely to get flooding. And if the storm surge is having to fight against fresh water trying to escape to the sea from inland, it makes matters worse. So all of these things are compounding. And let me just say that in addition to that, we have a demographic problem that's been documented for some time all over the world, which is that people are moving into hurricane-prone regions. In fact, the number of people living in regions susceptible to hurricanes has tripled since 1970. And so even if the climatology of these storms didn't change, we would have a lot more damage from these storms, and we certainly see a lot more damage. But on top of that, you have this collision of possibly stronger hurricanes, certainly rainier hurricanes, and in certain places, perhaps more hurricanes as well, and the increase in sea level. So all these factors are on a collision course, and it doesn't paint a very optimistic picture.
That's amazing. Millions of people are moving closer into the danger zone. Look, in 2018, I interviewed Dr. Jim Cawson of NOAA. He warned tropical cyclones or hurricanes are slowing down to leave a greater trail of destruction. It's sort of strange for the average listener because we hear that a hurricane may have winds of 150 miles an hour or greater, and yet it's slowly moving along at several miles an hour. What is translation speed in storms, and why does it matter so much?
Well, the translation speed is the rate at which the center of the storm moves across the sea or the land. So, you know, the typical storm in the North Atlantic may form, and the tropical Atlantic generally moves east or east-northeast and may recurve up to the north and west. But the speed at which it travels along that path is what we call the translation speed. Why it matters is all kinds of ways. Obviously, a fast-moving storm, you're not going to have as much time to evacuate people as if you have a slow-moving storm, assuming they both have fairly good track forecasts. A big concern, though, is if you have a storm that stalls near the coastline, as did Hurricane Harvey back in 2017, then the rain can last a lot longer, and you can get much more rain at a point than you would if the storm is moving fast. But there are other considerations as well. If the storm is moving slowly inland, it's not going to get very far before it dies. So if you're a city that's 100 miles inland from the coast, you might be better off with a slowly translating storm than one that's moving quickly. So there are all these factors. And at the end of the day, each storm is an individual storm and has to be treated for the particular hazards that it poses. And we're constantly getting better, fortunately, at forecasting these kinds of storms.
Something caught my eye in your paper in Nature Geoscience. Your team writes, quote, "Atmospheric aerosols provide an additional control over tropical cyclone occurrence on shorter timescales." Carrie, does that imply that our smog may have muted the appearance of tropical cyclones? And if we clean air pollution up, we may get more of these giant storms.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence for that. Here's what's going on. When you put aerosols in the atmosphere, unless they're very dark aerosols like carbon black, if you put, for example, sulfate aerosols, the main effect is to reflect sunlight back to space. And that cools the ocean. regionally where the aerosols have strong concentrations. I have to emphasize that aerosols are almost always regional. They're not global. They're not at all homogeneously distributed around the world because they don't stay in the atmosphere all that long, on average about 2 weeks. And so they don't get very far from, well, they get some distance from the source, but they don't last long enough to become uniform around the world. And that regional cooling can have profound effects on hurricanes. And we believe that the hurricane drought in the Atlantic in the 1970s and 1980s was an indirect effect of aerosols from fossil fuel combustion, mostly in northern Europe. Those aerosols get swept down over the Mediterranean and Africa in the summertime by the airflow at that time of year. They demonstrably caused a drought in the sub-Saharan region back in the 70s and 80s. And when you have a drought, a lot more dust from the desert gets lofted in the easterly winds and brought out over the Atlantic, and it's mostly that Saharan mineral dust that we think cooled the Atlantic in that period and led to a fairly dramatic reduction in both hurricane frequency and intensity. So, yeah, the Clean Air Act had, you might call it the black lining on the silver cloud of cleaning up the atmosphere, was it brought back the hurricanes.
Emissions are still going up, and in sort of a desperation, we hear more voices from good scientists talking about injecting stratospheric aerosols to cool the planet down could be needed in the future. What do we know about the impacts of doing that to storm intensity or frequency?
Well, fortunately, they'd be very small, and the reason is kind of simple. The amount of aerosol you'd have to put into the stratosphere to cool things down, and you would try to do that in a sort of globally uniform way, is pretty tiny compared to the amount of aerosol that we're accidentally already dumping into the lower part of the atmosphere we call the troposphere. So while there are many, you know, potential risks of doing this so-called solar radiation management, I don't think it's going to have that much effect regionally on hurricanes. But anytime you cool the whole climate down, as that's going to do, we would expect to ramp back down on the intensity of hurricanes. And in fact, I have a paper out with another group of authors that suggests that even if you only went halfway back to, say, the temperature of the pre-industrial era, you would probably go all the way back in terms of hurricane intensity. So, yeah, it does make a difference.
Is that paper already published?
Yes, it is. And the lead author, well, one of the authors is David Keith.
Ah, yes. We've interviewed David Keith and talked about him quite a bit. Now, you find the warming atmosphere could increase the polar shift, but may also decrease the chances tropical cyclones could happen. So it's a mixed bag in your December 2021 meta-analysis. That leads me to ask, is scientific knowledge about tropical cyclones solid enough now that we could warn people and governments what to prepare for, say, in 2030 or 2050?
Well, you know, it's an excellent question, and it's the most important question you can ask. Certainly, we don't know everything that we ought to know about these storms. And the projections are accompanied, and especially regionally, with a great deal of uncertainty. But I do think there, if you look at the robust parts of these results, I think they are sufficient to begin to take action. So, for example, just sea level rise, it's very clear that that's happening and will continue to happen. We need to already begin, we need to change our infrastructure to cope with sea level rise. And even if the hurricane climatology were not to change, you have a problem with higher storm surges just because they're riding on sea level. There's simple things like that, very robust conclusions you can begin to design for. The wind problem or the frequency problem is not entirely solved. And yet, if you really stop and think about it, many of the decisions we make in the real world every day and many of the decisions government have to make are made in environments of uncertainty. We're never completely certain about the future. We have to think probabilistically about these things and weigh the probabilities that there will be serious risks to deal with against the losses that may come from spending money, from spending to mitigate those risks now. So those are the tough decisions that we have to contemplate.
Well, as you point out in your book, Divine Winds, these big storms can change history. I wonder, can you picture a sci-fi future where humans would be able to either divert the storm from its track or and save a city or decrease its violence?
I can imagine things. I mean, there is, for example, an idea that's probably 10 or 15 years old, which is, I like to think of it as harnessing the butterfly. And what I'm alluding to there is the so-called, the well-known butterfly effect, which is a cornerstone of chaos theory developed by Ed Lorenz in the 1960s, which says that the atmosphere can be very, very sensitive to very tiny perturbations. You know, you have a butterfly, at least proverbially, a butterfly flapping its wings in South America, leading a few weeks later to a tornado in Texas. Harnessing the butterfly is not pure science fiction. If you can introduce perturbations of the right shape in the atmosphere at a particular place and time that will grow rapidly in amplitude as they move along the atmospheric currents, you can basically design such perturbations to achieve some desired effect. For example, a hurricane barreling toward the east coast of the U.S., if you tickle the atmosphere over the Pacific just the right way a few days earlier, you just change the natural progression of weather in such a way as the storm is turned harmlessly out to sea. That's not complete fantasy at all. There's a question of can we robustly design those perturbations, be relatively sure of the outcome, and then figure out some way of actually introducing them to the atmosphere. The beauty of the technique is it doesn't have to be big perturbations. It can be pretty small. Not literally as small as butterflies, but relatively small. So that's one technique. There are other ideas that are more involved directly modifying the hurricane, for example. Wave-driven pumps that pump cold water to the surface ahead of the hurricane can reduce its intensity. So they're kind of out there, but they're not so far out there as that they're not deserving of more research and consideration.
Carrie, on a personal level, how worried are you about the unstable atmosphere we are leaving to the coming generations?
Well, I am worried about it. I'm also optimistic. I think enough people are beginning to take it seriously. I think enough people are on board with the idea that we're incurring a risk for future generations, that things are beginning to happen. And I'd also say another basis of optimism is that changing the way we generate energy and use energy, it's not all gloom and doom. There's some real opportunities here. Let me just state one. There are many, many that I think we have to consider. Right at the moment, according to the World Health Organization, about 8.7 million people die around the world prematurely as a consequence mostly of pulmonary problems stemming from aerosols from fossil fuel combustion. So in other words, burning fossil fuels kills almost 9 million people a year. Just think about that a minute. If I said, well, nuclear power kills 900 people a year, there would be a huge outcry, and we would shut down all the nuclear power plants. Of course, it doesn't. But we're happily living with 9 million premature deaths. That's a great opportunity to solve that problem by cleaning up combustion or better yet, migrating to green energy, which doesn't have that problem. There are all kinds of economic opportunities for countries that develop clean energy most efficiently and cheaply and fastest are going to make out very well economically. So electric cars, you know, once you've driven an electric car, you would never go back to a gas engine. The electric motor is a thing of beauty, hardly ever needs even to be maintained. You can just forget about taking the car to the shop except to get the tires rotated and so forth. So there are a lot of things to be optimistic about, and yet the transformation is often painted by all kinds of different interests and journalists and so forth as a very negative thing. We're going to have to give up this way of life and go back to the Stone Ages. Not at all. I think we can make a lot of progress and wind up much better off than we are at the moment.
From the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, we've been speaking with world-leading expert in extreme weather, Dr. Carrie Emanuel. Look for his latest book, Climate Science and Climate Risk, A Primer, for the educated non-specialist. Find links to Carrie's website and all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Carrie, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.